Hello, my name is Andreina.
And my name is Gabriela, and this is Wicks and Candles,
a podcast about two sisters and their obsession with period film.
Join us on a trip through palaces and manors, balls and tea parties, and a lot of dresses, carriages, and of course, wicks and candles.
In this episode, The Wonder. Today we are discussing the 2022 Netflix original film, The Wonder, and we have a little bit of a trigger warning. In our discussion, we will be talking about eating disorders and sexual assault. If you feel that this topic is uncomfortable for you, you might want to skip this episode and come back for the next. So, Gabby, I think this is the first thriller that we are discussing in our podcast series.
Yes, Nene, it's quite an unusual film for the Wicks and Candles team, but I would say a quite refreshing one.
Okay, great. But can we start with some facts about the movie?
Sure, Nene. The Wonder was released in 2022, and it's based on the book by the same name by Irish-Canadian writer Emma Donoghue. It was directed by Chilean director Sebastián Lelio, and it features Florence Pugh on the role of Lib Wright, Keila Lord Cassidy as Anna O'Donnell, and Tom Burke as journalist Will Byrne. Now, with Florence Pugh as an Academy Award nominee for her role in Little Women in 2019, she was back then nominated for an actress in a supporting role, and with Sebastián Lelio being internationally acclaimed for his films, it's no surprise that this movie as well has a long list of awards nominations, including a nomination for a BAFTA Film Award for Outstanding British Film of the Year. So quite a impressive row of accolades. How about the plot, Nene?
Yeah, thank you, Gabby. Actually, that's so interesting. I didn't know that it was nominated for a BAFTA. So that's quite amazing. So yeah, so I'm going to give a short summary of the story, as I always try to do. So here goes. The Wonder tells the story of Elizabeth Wright, Lib, a nurse who is hired to watch over Anna O'Donnell, a young girl living in a rural Irish village in 1862. Lib has been hired by a committee trying to determine how Anna has been able to survive without food for 4 months. Her family, along with some powerful members of the church, believe she's a living miracle chosen by God. Lib will try to use her knowledge, her own instincts, and most of all, her compassion to uncover the truth and try to help Anna. Okay, so I try to reveal as least as possible in this summary, because we're going to get into it during the discussion. All right.
Very well.
Okay. So should I start it, Gabby?
Sure.
Yeah. So this is first of all, to start a discussion, this is an unusual movie in many respects. It's not an unusual movie, but an unusual period film. When you think about the genre. So the first thing that that struck us is that this is more like a period thriller. Like it functions more like a mystery, but that it happens in the past. So we wanted to talk, first of all, does it work? Does it add anything to the pleasure of watching the movie or to the story? What do you think, Abby? Does this period thriller or mystery work for you?
Well, Nene, I was thinking about this after I finished the film, because as you say, it's quite unusual for the genre of period films. What we have been talking about in our series of podcasts so far is usually either a historical remake of real part of history or love stories and so on. So I would say the genre itself it's not known for thriller stories. Mm-hmm. So it's within the period film genre. It is quite unusual. And this is maybe interesting to say, what is it, a thing of taste? What do you look for when you're a period film lover? Yeah. And what you are attracted to when you want to see period films. And is it the looks, is it the entire surrounding, the atmosphere that is conveyed with a period film that you want to be kind of transported to the time? Then this would maybe not be the typical film for a period film lover. On the other hand, for thriller fans, then this may be very interesting to have it set somewhere in the past. So I think I would put myself more in the first category. I would put myself more in the category of being a period film drama for the feeling that a film conveys of another time, more than a thriller fan. Now I'm interested to hear your position.
We love the genre of period movies because of all the things that the period films represent, right? There's like this, the aesthetic level, right? The visual level. There's also the historical aspect where we learn about the lives of people during major historical events and all kinds of things. But we have learned in this series that really, you know, the past is important, obviously, when we're discussing, and the historical context is important. But what we have learned, I think, is that it's the lives of people and their emotions and their reactions to their surroundings that are the most interesting in any discussion that we have about period movies so far. So in this sense, this movie very much works for me.
It does work for you. Because I was thinking that I tried to imagine whether the story itself, the story didn't need the period to be told. The story could be told in another setting.
Yeah.
I would say. It could be told in the 1990s, in the 2000s.
Yep.
This is why I said, okay, do we really need to put this story in 1862?
I completely agree with you, because that's something I thought about as well when I was watching. I was like, the thing is that we have to, again, go back to our summary of the movie and our facts about the movie. This is based on a novel, fictional story, and it's a book of fiction, but the novel by Emma Donoghue is based on real cases of what came to be known fasting girls, that this phenomenon of these fasting girls occurred over many centuries in Europe and America, the continent of America, not America, the country, sorry, I'm rambling. So she was, Emma Donoghue was fascinated by this phenomenon of the fasting girls, how it was different from the more medical term that we would use today, such as anorexia, for example. So It's an excellent observation, because I thought the same thing. This book, this story could happen today.
Mm-hmm.
It could happen today. It's like almost like a medical
a medical case.
It's a medical case. Like, it's funny. The movie itself is a period film, but it's also like a mystery. And it's also like a medical mystery where somebody's trying to solve a medical case. Yeah, so it's true. It could happen anytime, but I think the fact that she set the story in a very specific time, I think helps with the religious connotations that the movie has, like all the religious context and all the religious topics that are touched on. She plays it in Ireland, and specifically a few years after the Great Famine that killed thousands and thousands of people. So I think that specific context of the, you know, a famine, you know, the potato famine that killed so many Irish and traumatized a nation, you know, the link with somebody who's choosing not to eat. So all of those connections make it more interesting and kind of like to be in the period, like to be in that particular historical moment.
Well, it is, I would say, valid to say that setting the story in 1862, of course, it adds some type of eeriness and gives you, of course, the feeling of being trapped in that, in that distorted society, because of course we know it 150 years later. Of course, we have a bigger knowledge of science, and I don't know, we can differentiate more or a little bit better than back then between science and fictions and whatever. So of course it adds this eeriness and this feeling of people back then didn't know any of this, or would tend to fall more into ignorant beliefs. So of course one could say, okay, back then they were like trapped in this world, what they didn't know, well, they didn't know any better. But as I said, yeah, I think it's a story that could be told in any yeah, other time.
Yeah, it's true. However, I do feel that the period specific aspects, yeah, aspects of the movie, I think they work well. But it's true. I think we can, because we're already talking about religion and we're talking mm-hmm. about beliefs, I think we can move on perhaps to the next topics, which are addressed in the movie. And the movie is quite profound, actually. It really makes you think about deeply about these topics that we're gonna mention here. So it's about the juxtaposition of opposing belief systems, such as science versus religion, faith versus rationality, and so on. Because Liv is a nurse, and she's sent to observe this girl who supposedly has been chosen by God to live without food. So here we are opposing this religious belief with her scientific knowledge, and what happens when the two meet. What do you think about this, Gabby?
This is the core of the story, I would say, to unravel how she's representing the scientific, the rational side of the medical case. And she's not the only one watching Anna. Maybe we should add this. She's not the only one watching Anna. This committee who wants to kind of, actually they're searching for proof for the miracle. Actually, that's what they're hoping for, to prove the miracle. So they were still open to have kind of like, okay, the scientific side of investigation represented by the nurse. And they also hired a nun to kind of have also the religious side of the investigation. I think it's very clear from the beginning where the story is going. It's very clear that they give it away pretty easily, that she's representing science and she's representing rationality and she's driving the story. So you can already assume very early in the story she will figure it out. She will come behind the secret of the entire thing. I think it's very well portrayed. I think it's very well portrayed because it touches very cleverly on how to build the bridge, because even though she is very rational and very scientific, how does she build the bridge to get into Anna's mind, who is completely focused on the religious, on the faith, on her belief? So it's her character is challenged by finding that bridge, even though she's completely convinced that there is a rational explanation for this. Uh-huh. She knows that to get behind it, she has to reach out to Anna, who's completely obsessed with the other side of the story.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I love that, how you call that, that she has to build a bridge between her rationality, her scientific knowledge, in trying to find a rational explanation for how is it possible that this girl hasn't eaten for 4 months, and Anna's beliefs and the family's beliefs in order to, you know, yeah, bridge the two and actually get through to them or get through to Anna. So I noticed that. I think it was so well written, and this probably really shows the progression of Liv, and how she figures out how to build this bridge. She comes in, she's a nurse, she has served as a nurse in the Crimean War, she has seen death, she has seen men die of horrible wounds. She is trained. Today she will be a doctor, clearly. Liv, if she was alive today, she would be a doctor. She would not be a nurse. She actually behaves like a doctor. I mean, she's just doing all the functions. Anyway, but what is interesting is how the script, we can see the progression of how she comes in. She's never imposing any way. She's always very matter of fact and clear, and she does her work, but she's never not compassionate. And that's what I loved about this character. She always approaches the case with the utmost compassion and empathy, trying to understand what is happening here. Is this, first of all, she comes in saying it is impossible that this girl has survived for 4 months without food. So, yeah, the committee is trying to prove the miracle. True, well said, because they are not trying to prove otherwise. They want her to say yes. They want the answer they want is for the nun and for Liv to say, yes, we watched her 24 hours and we never saw food pass her lips. Yes, she's alive and we don't know how. That's the answer they want.
They are looking forward.
Yeah. That's the answer that they are looking for, at least most of the members of the committee, because there's a couple of more rational ones. But Liv comes in already knowing that this is impossible, that this is not humanly possible, this is not scientifically possible. So what she's there to find out is how have they kept her alive?
Yeah, and that's kind of very clear from the beginning. So
from the beginning, you're
joining her on this journey, as you mentioned, on this mystery, to solve the mystery case. Okay, how is this done?
She comes in, how is this being done? Like, okay, she supposedly has not eaten for 4 months. There must be a way that this girl is getting some nourishment, because I know scientifically it's not possible. And she never, I found this really wonderful of the script and of the character, that she never wavers in her belief. She doesn't get into some mystical trip where she's like, well, I was so afraid of that. I was so afraid that suddenly we as viewers were going to be thrown into this slippery floor where we don't know where we're standing. It's like, oh, no. And like,
could this be true?
Are you suggesting that this miracle actually happened and left us a question mark? This is not the point of the movie at all. We're on Liv's side, and this is very reassuring as a viewer to have this extraordinary character with such integrity and just, you know, her beliefs, her knowledge is just her biggest, strongest tool that she has.
Well, and I think that's what makes it so compelling and what so relatable. And actually what you say is so admirable as well. What you mentioned at the beginning, that she was not imposing, that she was not arrogant on her position of,
no.
I know better than everybody because
no.
I come from the scientific point of view and I know better. She was never like that, which I how you formulated was quite good. She's not imposing in her views. And I think what makes her so empathetic, what you also mentioned, which makes it so compassionate and empathetic is, first of all, I think because she's a woman.
Yeah.
And secondly, because we learn through the story that she has also experienced a grave loss.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it very human, makes mm-hmm. her very human at the mm-hmm. same time. So she's not purely rational. She very well has deep feelings. And this is exactly what she tries to tell the parents of Anna.
Yeah.
Maybe we can say something about that. We see that the what she's deeper in her observation, and she kind of already has an idea where all this is coming from. She realizes that the parents of Anna are very well involved in this in this construct of keeping Anna alive, what making everybody believe she's miraculous.
Mm-hmm.
So she figures that out. She doesn't tell them on the face, "Hey, I know you're playing a role here." She's clever enough to approach them from that point of view, to
yes.
approach them from the compassion and empathy point of view, to say, she doesn't really say it, that she said, okay, I respect what you're trying to do, because of course the family is trying to keep the appearance of a very religious family, and of course they keep a very dark secret in the family, and they are aware that if this comes out, this family secret comes out, they are completely ruined, not just
yeah.
as a family, but maybe as an entire community.
Uh-huh.
So she has this cleverness to say, to omit that, because she says, okay, I respect that you have a very dark past and I don't want to open that box. But I was a mother and you are a mother. We can talk about that.
Yes.
That link is between us, and you know very well how hard it is to lose a child. So let me get you through that. That was kind of clever.
Oh.
How she approached the family. And I am a team leader in my job, in my real life job.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I am a team leader, and as in leadership trainings and in leadership concepts and learnings, it's always the core of how to be a good leader is always finding that main surface to build rapport, to build trust with someone, to gain the person into what you're seeking, what you want to achieve and what you want to reach. So you cannot put the goal in front of you and kind of break through just because you want to reach that goal. You have to reach the person, and you have to find the key on how to build that rapport. And from the leadership point of view, I think she did it so clever, because it's not easy. It's not easy to find the key, to put into the keyhole. let me tell you.
Yeah.
I know it from, it's quite hard. But once you find that ground, once you find that common ground, you can build that rapport and you can reach the person on a completely different level. And then you can win their trust and reach the goal. And that's exactly what Lieb Wright did. She didn't quite get there, but she managed. She managed to find that path to the mother, at least.
Yeah. Oh, but that is such an incredible perspective from a completely different discipline. Leadership. We were talking about multidisciplinary approaches to analysis, to film analysis, just before we started recording. And there you have it. That is so fascinating, Gabby. I think that's one of the most interesting aspects of this character, that she did find the key to open the door. It didn't quite work, but she did build that bridge. She did find a way to communicate to them the urgency of saving Anna from this charade, because they will gonna lose her. And I don't know if we should reveal here. We always give a warning to listeners that you should watch the movie before, because there will be spoilers. So watch the movie and then come back to the podcast. So what you mentioned that the family is keeping a dark secret, because what is really also an important question to ask ourselves as viewers is what is this family trying to achieve? Why is this family doing this? This is a mother and a father. I think there's an aunt, very young, and there's Anna. And very soon after Liv arrives, she learns that there was also an older brother who died. So the shadow of this older brother is kind of hanging over the whole story for a long time. And then, you know, you start asking, what is the purpose for this family? What is their motivation? That's the word.
And what is the motivation of Anna?
What is the motivation of Anna?
Of Anna.
In Anna, in not wanting to eat or keeping this hoax or charade, passing as a miracle. Like, what is the motivation of this family? And little by little, Lib, through a lot of effort and a lot of compassion and profound thinking and reflection, we learn that Anna has been starving herself almost because she is trying to save her brother from eternal damnation in hell. Because we learn he assaulted her from age 9 for several years until he died. So she feels that to save his soul, she has to sacrifice herself in order for him to be saved. It's part of, she believes she has to pray 33 times a day, and she has to do this complete fast to save his soul. So that is the motivation of the family, and the family is kind of believing, you know, we need to do this to save his soul. Even if that means losing Anna.
Losing Anna. In that moment, their heavenly salvation is more important.
Their heavenly salvation is more important.
At some point, even though they are aware that they cannot do it, that they cannot go full Monty, they are aware that they have to keep this myth alive, and this is why they secretly feed her
small amounts of food
amounts of food.
So it's you know, that is the family's motivation, is very much based on faith and belief, but also appearances. This is a small rural village that has suffered again through the famine. They have terrible things, entire families die. And there's something about the appearance. It's, I don't know, I guess they needed a miracle. I guess they wanted to have some, you know, because the thing is, they use Anna. People come to visit her all the time. They have visitors, people praying and holding her hands, and just people just you know, the fervently kind of believing they are seeing a miracle, and they're, you know, she's being examined and talked about. So there's some sort of not fame, but there's some sort of renown that they're actually getting through all of this too.
Yeah, and this is maybe also quite a controversial part of the story, that in that way we also realize that Anna has been instrumentalized by her own family. Mm. She is victim in so many ways. Because as we say, the parents are actually aware that she cannot really live without any food. Yeah, they are aware of that. But they need to keep this myth alive to save their reputation, to save the community's reputation, to kind of also make them like the martyrs, you know. Oh. We will give the village a saint because we haven't had a saint in this area for I don't know how many centuries. Oh. And how they aim that, yeah. And with that, they are victimizing Anna completely.
Over and over.
And she's a child, so of course she falls into this, okay, I have to save my soul and my brother's soul, but of course she's not aware of anything else that is behind it, that is attached to it. Ugh. This is, yeah,
it is, that moment is horrifying. The moment that we learn this is so horrifying. And it's a really great scene with amazing acting and amazing pacing. it is truly excellent. She's being victimized over and over again, first by her brother, then her parents, then the whole town, then the village, the committee. Everybody wants a miracle and live. Among all of these people, she's the only one who sees a little girl, this young human girl who is far from a miracle, who is just beautiful for who she is. And she sees the tragedy that is happening right in front of her eyes. Because other people, the adults in her life, so need a miracle and so need something to, I guess, elevate them from the everyday. I don't know.
It's a good theory. Yeah.
So Liv very determinedly finds a solution. Maybe we should not reveal it. Maybe we should leave that for, you know, even if you have watched it, I think you know what happens. If you have seen the movie, you know what happens. She finds a marvelous solution to save Anna.
It's a clever cue. Nene, now, the story is way above, as we said already in our first topic. All these topics and the story itself, the entire plot, what is behind it, how did they come to this, and how she solved the case. This is well above the fact that this is a period film, you know? Uh-huh, uh-huh. So I think the story is the protagonist and not beautiful dresses and beautiful settings.
No.
Yeah. So how did you find the entire style of the film? How did you, as I said, it's not a typical period film, but if you're as a period film lover, you go into it and said, okay, this is from another time, I will watch it. How does the entire style of the film work for you? How did you like the entire cinematography? And what did you like best out of it?
Oh, this is a very unusual period film, but in a sense, it's very much a period film in a way. Like, it has an idea of period and it presents it. Like, it has an idea of what time was, how things were, and really very much it sticks to that idea and notion. So there's very few settings, very few sources of light. There's a lot of outdoor shots. There's a lot of things. This is one of my, at the beginning, the first time I saw this movie, I was very puzzled. I said, oh my God, what do I have something to hold on here? Like, I don't have anything to hold on to. It was so different. Like, I was really unsure. It's like, oh my goodness, is there anything, Peter, that I can talk to, like that I can talk about here? Because, you know, it's very spare. Like, it happens in a rural village. It happens mainly in the house of the family. And this is by, you know, not a luxurious home by any stretch of the imagination. It's extremely bare and plain and even poor. And we'd spend a lot of time in Anna's room, and there's just a bed. The walls are like bare walls, and usually very often you have one or two sources of light during the indoor scenes. Like, you would have a window, and that's the only source of light coming in. Or you'll have a couple windows illuminating a couple of characters from opposing sides, and usually they're very low. So I guess they really went and looked at how a house from 1862 would have looked like in rural Ireland. It's a sturdy house, but very dark, probably kind of cold a little bit.
Yeah, damp.
Damp. And the second setting, I think, is just the inn where she's staying. She doesn't stay with the family. She stays at an inn where she has her own room, which also only has one source of light. Like, I don't see lamps.
No. Well, there were candles. There were some candles.
But few candles. Few candles, because the indoor scenes, like in the house, is usually like daylight.
It's usually just daylight coming through the
windows. Through the windows. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. It's like a daylight movie. It's not too many night scenes. But it might as well be night. Might as well be night, because we are in, for Liv, she's, you know, realizing this horrendous secret and this world of beliefs. So much darkness.
So much darkness. What do you think? Nene, I really like the entire style, the aesthetics, the visual style of the film. I think that was maybe professional is a very dry word, but I think it was very minimalistic, and it was very very elegant. You know, the choice of what we mentioned, the light was really fascinating. There's a scene of Lib, or a couple of scenes of Lib with Anna in her room. And as you mentioned, the only source of light is the little window, which is also low.
Yeah,
it's low. Not like above, it's not at the height of their head, so it's a little bit low. So it kind of radiates a little bit up. And they play so well with light and how the light falls on their faces. Ugh. Because Lib has to do all these examinations on Anna only based on this little light. And she looks into her eyes and you see this daylight, this little bit of light flowing over their faces. And that was very nicely done, very well done. I like that a lot. And of course, the outdoor scenes are breathtaking, breathtaking. It gives you, of course, this feeling of the roughness of the landscape, the time, and the life of Lib, of Anna, because you often see this hut or this little house in the middle of a huge meadow and nothing else around it. So you feel like this desperation. Oh my gosh, this family is just like somewhere in the middle of nowhere, and you cannot really get to them.
Wow.
You know, like this loneliness feeling of this huge meadow and the wind. Yeah? So the roughness of, I think they played very well with that, with the outdoor scenes, the roughness of the landscape. And the time, kind of like, that makes you feel like I want to get out of here.
Oh my God, I so agree with you. I think there's three main settings: the house, the hut, or the family house, the family home, then the inn. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of scenes where she's walking in the streets, thinking, but very, very, very few. And then the third setting, which I think is almost a character, is the outdoors. And there's a specific place in the outdoors. Yeah, and what you were trying to say is the isolation.
the isolation
of this family, because they don't live in town. All the community, mm-hmm. all those people, they live in town. They see other people, where this family is completely isolated in so many ways. For example, the aunt, or I don't know if it's the eldest sister, who's learning to read. So isolated from knowledge, from reading, isolated from other people, isolated from other houses, isolated from any modern technology,
civilization
they might have access to, right? So they are isolated in every possible way, and even from, you know, scientific knowledge taking place just a few miles away, right? Like, you know, it's very symbolic. But there's one specific area in the movie that is almost like a character, which is the path. And I don't know what it means, but this path is so important in the movie, which is a beautiful path from the house out. It's a path, the path that leads out from the house to the outdoors, and I guess to the town. We never see it end. We only see her coming out or in. And it's like, we see the meadows and we see the flowers, and she's always there are many, many scenes when she's walking that path, either going to the house or going out, and she's thinking, and she's thinking in this path, like she's trying to, you know, build that bridge, or it is very symbolic to me and really interesting. And I really love every single scene that she shows her. And she meets a very important character that we haven't mentioned yet, which is a journalist who's writing a story on Anna and trying to interview Liv to have her perspective. And they kind of team up. In the end, they kind of team up to, quote unquote, solve the mystery, save Anna, and so on. And there's also many scenes where they're walking up and down this path, and also with Anna, because she will take Anna for walks as well. So this path with flowers on the side, the wind, her dress, her blue, like lips, blue dress against it. It's just very, it's like memorable. It stays in your mind.
Absolutely.
It can represent knowledge, freedom, it can represent so many things after you come out of the house. Probably this path represents symbolizes many, many things, because that's where she does all the thinking, and where she goes back from the inn, where she has all her issues that she's dealing with. She even takes, I think, laudanum. She gets high on laudanum, like at night, to ease her own pain, which you mentioned already, that humanizes her as well.
Mm-hmm.
So she, you know, it path from her pain to her role here. It's wonderful.
It's really wonderful. And there's one thing, Nene, also about the aesthetics of the film and also about the entire cinematography. There's two scenes that we haven't talked about.
Mm.
And I want to ask your opinion about that.
Yeah.
The opening and the closing scene. It's a mix of modern and old. The opening scene of this film is actually a film studio, a completely modern film studio that turns the camera into an old 19th century ship. And at the end, we are in a 19th century ship, and the camera moves away from that scenery again back to the modern film studio. How did this affect you? How did you like this touch of the director?
Oh, well, you're putting me on the spot, because I haven't thought about this too much, even though it's so unusual and strange. And I think it's just about, you know, we're going to tell you a story and you're going to choose what you want to believe kind of framing, because we do move from this narrator off camera, but what we're seeing is a studio, a modern studio, and then the camera zooms in into the set, like suddenly you're in 1862. Like if the camera zooms in, you see it from outside, and then zoom in and you are in this world immediately. Mm-hmm. very well done and very, you know, it says a lot. It's like, you know, we're going to transport you to a time and place that you are not familiar with and prepare yourself for what you might see and find and learn from this time and the people who lived in it, kind of like preparing you for that. Beware, beware, you might encounter things that you don't understand, kind of thing. And then at the end, I'm not sure what to make of it. What do you think?
You're not sure what to make of it. Well, I was puzzled at the beginning when with the opening scene. I was like, did I click on the wrong film?
Yeah.
Is this really a period film? So of course, the director was clever in that sense of making this unusual, like something that will make his film memorable. And at the end, again, now whether it really worked for me, I don't know. As I said, I am a very classic period film lover, so I want to stay in that time. I don't want anything to take me out of the time. So I'm a little bit puzzled, and then I might even say to conclude that I might be even a little bit irritated, even though it's aesthetically and from the production point of view, and to tell the story, what you just mentioned, to kind of you choose what to believe on from the story, because you know we're on a film set where just, you know, we make fiction, we make fantasy, it's another word, it's a construction. So you choose what to believe in. So that might be very cleverly thought, but I don't know if it really works for me, because as I said, I didn't need it. Maybe didn't need it. I will always remember it.
Yeah,
but maybe I didn't need it because I like to stay in the time. I don't know. It takes me out of the time.
Yeah, it is a bit puzzling, and I don't know what to make of it. It didn't irritate me, but I don't know if it's necessary. I mean, it's like a framing device. It works for me at the beginning. But did I need it at the end? I'm not sure if I needed it at the end. I got the point at the beginning that we're going to show you something that is this, that, you know, you might encounter something that you might not understand, but remember, this is a construction and all stories are constructions. You know, it's saying mm-hmm. something about the topic itself, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The family was constructing this miracle. It's all fiction. Mm-hmm. What is real, what is not real, and how do you decide? We are talking about it. We remember it.
Exactly. We are talking about it. So he reached his goal.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe with more viewings, you know, we will come to understand it, or it will, you know, there are things like that. And I think with movies, books, music, it takes time. It takes time to understand them. I think in our culture today, because we have so much, and everybody's talking about it, and there's a new thing that comes, we don't take time to really absorb things. Take our time to absorb them, and things take time to absorb.
And yeah, absolutely.
I'm just ranting here. I'm just using this moment to rant about, you know, there's a new album. You need time to listen to it because you will absorb and you will understand. And same with this movie. And maybe I will watch it again. I say, no, it doesn't work. But maybe I'll watch it again. And I'll say, oh,
you and you what? Say, no, wow, I got what you wanted to say.
I got it. But if I didn't get it the very first time, did it work? Anyway, it's just interesting.
It's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting.
Okay. So now that we have talked about all of these incredible topics and there's many more. These movies, you know, there's so many other things that we could talk about, especially about Lib as a nurse in the 19th century, and, you know, what a character. But we need to move on, and we are going to move on to our Wicks and Candles quiz, which we introduce this season. So what we do is we ask each other four questions, and this gives us a chance to talk a little bit more about things that we liked or didn't like in the movie and so on. So I'm going to start with the first question for Gabby. What is your sweaty Wick, which means one thing you didn't like about the movie?
Thank you, Nina. Nene, I have two sweaty weeks. You know that I'm always very indecisive and I always have more than one. I have two sweaty weeks. And we will certainly discuss this now. The first sweaty week, if you see the entire film, when I watched the entire film, I thought that the storytelling is from the timing somehow weird. In the story, it is clear that she's supposed to watch Anna only for 2 weeks. They say that right at the beginning. But in the film, there's so many things happening and so many, there's so many back and forth of Lip and Anna. And she goes, she sleeps, she goes, she finds out something, she comes again and whatever. That it feels like much, much longer than it was actually was. So that makes it kind of unbelievable, you know? And at the end, Anna is on the verge of death. And I was like already wondering, how did this happen so fast? Mm-hmm. How did this happen so fast? So I think they had some minor mistakes on the storytelling, on the scripts, which make me kind of, you know, disbelieve. The entire plot itself is so well thought through. But how they portrayed it, like sometimes they were like okay, how did she really get bad within like, I don't know, half of
a
her
week.
Observing in a week? Is this, does it really happen so fast? Yeah, on the verge of death. I don't know. I found, like I said, there was a little bit of a mistake on the writing, how to the pace of a story. That's why my sweaty week. And I'm going to throw you another one. And I am interested in seeing how you think about that. It has to do with the character of Lip, the character played by Florence Pugh. We have talked about in other episodes of Wicks and Candles about this unmistakable heroine who is too ahead of her time in a period story, in a period drama. That the main character or the heroine is too clever and too modern and ahead of her time. And how either it works because they keep her in her time, in the context, in the time context, or it's too modern that doesn't really fit. And I think in this case of The Wonder, the main character, Lip Wright, is too modern, is ahead of her time. She wears earrings, which also irritated me a little bit. She wears earrings and she does things that for me are very, very modern. Her body language is also very modern. There's a scene where she discusses with the journalist on this path that you mentioned. They're having kind of a discussion, kind of a fight because she wants him to help her. And he's not quite convinced. And her body language is too modern for my taste. Too modern. How she, you know, she stands there like kind of a like slangy, loose way. And how she touches him and waves her hand at him like, would you help me? And her body language is for me too modern. A nurse in her time would stand straight and move as little as possible. These women were constrained in tight dresses and were told to be constrained. So I think her body language, her earrings, the looks. There's one scene when she's alone in her room and she misses her husband and so on. She feels very lonely. And she kind of tries to masturbate a little bit. This is too modern. This is, I guess, like ahead of her time. That didn't really work for me. Those are my two sweaty weeks.
Wow.
How about yours?
Those are two very good sweaty weeks. And I agree actually with the timing piece. I didn't think of it, but now that you mention it, 100%. And we would need our sister-in-law, Mase, who's a doctor, to weigh in on this. Because true, like for the first maybe 3 days. I don't. Yeah, exactly. We don't know exactly when she finds out that the family is giving her food and when she realizes, oh my God, this is how they're keeping her alive. They're giving her food when they kiss her, when they hug her, and so on. And she says, you cannot touch her anymore. And that's when Anna's real life is in danger, because now nobody can pass her food, and she starts to die in front of her eyes. But it happens really fast. And she
it happens really fast. Two weeks.
Yeah. So that's a great 20 week. Good point. The second one, I agree with you in certain scenes, but overall, I appreciate it very much how Florence Pugh played this character, because it was borderline. It was like, at moments I was like, she's going into exceptional girl territory. Oh,
exceptional girl territory. She fell completely into the exceptional girl territory.
But there was always something that kind of kept her in her time. And I have to keep reminding myself, she's a nurse. She's seen death. She has touched men's bodies to save them, to stop them from bleeding, cutting legs, giving medicine, holding people down for surgery. She's done it. She's done a kind of work that would erase any kind of shyness or any. I'm trying to find the word in English. In Spanish is pudor, but I don't know what in English is, like any kind of shyness in terms of how you move and behave with people around you, because she has kind of gone beyond that barrier as a nurse. Yeah, but that scene in the pathway, I 100% agree, because that scene stood out for me saying, oh, this doesn't quite work. That scene for me didn't quite work, and it was the acting and it was the choices that Florence Pugh made. But it was just that one scene. Mm-hmm. So I agree with you. Okay.
My sweaty
week is one character. Like, I was like, oh, I love this movie so much. But I was thinking. And yes, there was one character, the nun. The community hires a nun and Liv to watch over Anna and come back with a report and verify the miracle. I never understood. There's like a hint at some point saying that she's also a nurse, but dressed as a nun. And I watched it again, and I was like, I missed it. It's like, I could never understand who this person was. Did this person help? I was very confused by this character of the nurse, of the nun. And it's a very minor character, but she was there kind of like 12 hours. Liv will do 12 hours and she will come and do the next 12 hours. And that's how they did it, right? So there was a moment when I thought, oh, she's also a nurse, but she's dressed as a nun just so that they could ease her in, just like they could ease her into the family. It's like, well, they will accept a nurse if there's also a nun.
Oh, I didn't spot that. I think it was a real nurse. A real nun.
Yeah. So
I didn't spot that. I think it was a real nun.
Yeah. So the misuse of this character, or the lack of use of this character, or the lack of development of, you know, I don't know. It's a minor sweaty week. It's a little kid's sweaty week.
It's like a little marshmallow.
It's a little marshmallow sweaty week. A tiny sweaty week, but it was just like, yeah, little things like that didn't quite work.
But the character is very on the background. Yeah, she's very decorative.
Yeah,
is it? They only want to bring this element of, okay, she will represent religion and faith.
Yeah,
irrational. Religion. Yeah. She will represent that. And so she plays a very minor role. But at the very end, she is aware of what Lip did. She knows that, and she also very cleverly asks from her position as a nun, she asks, is she doing well? Has she gone to a better place?
Has she gone to a better place?
But she knows she has to keep her nun role.
Yeah.
But she actually knows what Lip did. So
I love that.
That was kind of clever. So I didn't have my issues with a nun.
Like I said, it's a very small, sweaty week. But you know what? She has one of the greatest scenes in the movie, which is just that scene that you just mentioned. Mm. So the nun, even though it's a very underdeveloped character, I didn't understand. Like, maybe because The only reason I will have a problem with it is because I thought that they said she's a nurse hiding, dressed as a nun,
okay.
and that aspect will be underdeveloped. But if she's mm-hmm. a real nun, then it's okay. But she does get one of the greatest lines and greatest mm-hmm. dialogues in the whole movie at the
in
end.
The whole movie, yes.
Okay, so let's move on to the next question. What is your shining candle, one thing you love about the movie?
Nene, I'm going to have to go for the looks. I'm going to have to go for the cinematography and the looks of the film, the lights, the outdoors. I like the, I like it. One fact, as I say, it's a very visual thing. Lip wears the same dress pretty much the entire film, pretty much.
Yeah.
90% of the film, she wears a blue dress. And I loved to see it getting dirty.
Oh, yeah.
Because she would walk from the town to the house on this path, and it would be wet and whatever. And the more it goes into the movie, the dirtier the the bottom of the dress got. So I think the cinematography was really well done. That's my shining candle. How about yours?
Oh my God. We are twins. We are
soulmates. Oh my gosh.
That's why we have a podcast together. I also gave my shining candle to the cinematography by Ari Wegner. She's a female cinematographer, and she most recently worked in the movie The Power of the Dog,
for which
she received, and I'm going to quote Wikipedia, for which, quote, she received widespread critical acclaim, including an Academy Award nomination for Best Cinematography, becoming only the second woman to do so in the award's 94-year history, end quote. So I loved it without knowing who he was, and then I went mm-hmm. and looked her up, and I said, my goodness, this is brilliant. And I haven't seen The Power of the Dog.
Beautiful.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and she did it. And for me, the way she shot the outdoors is wonderful, but the real magic of her work happens for scenes. The real magic is inside. The way she positions those windows and the light and made it symbolic, you know, the symbolism of the lighting, you know, the form informed. I love this. I love when form, which is the way things look, the way things are shaped or made, informs the meaning, informs the narrative just silently. You know, this is visual storytelling, and, you know, all these indoor scenes and dark woods and damp walls and, you know, yeah, very few candles because we're using this the daylight, but the outdoors. It truly is sort of like another character for me in this movie.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The landscape. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm thinking of two more shining candles.
Oh my God. Okay. Let's do it quick.
But I don't know. Something that we haven't talked about. I don't know if it's exactly shining candle. Maybe just a very low flame.
a little birthday candle.
Then two things that we haven't talked about, which stood out in the film. The music. I would like to have your opinion as well as the music, because the music is also kind of modern, and they purposely made it very eerie, because I think they wanted to accentuate the mystery tone of the film.
Yeah.
It's kind of a very eerie, ethereal music. And I liked it that as soon as she started figuring out and coming closer to the solution, that the music changes, and it's like a ticking clock.
I was going to say percussive. Yeah, it's percussive. It's tick, tick, tick.
It's like raising the pace, because now she's under time pressure to save her. And that was kind of clever.
I agree with you that the music, the soundtrack is great as well. It's very different, unusual.
Completely. Also for a period film, completely unusual. It's also too modern for a period film.
Yeah.
This is maybe also one aspect of what made me believe, okay, they could have told the story somewhere.
Yeah.
somewhere on some other time. But it was cleverly done. And as I said, the switch of of ethereal kind of, yes, mysterious music to this percussive, would you say? Okay, because now she's on the right path, and I found it kind of clever. And maybe one other thing that we didn't talked about so far. Okay, I'm gonna keep that for later on the quiz.
Okay,
so we can go on, and I'm gonna keep that for
all
later.
All right. Okay, so the third question of the quiz is stolen costume or prop. What place or clothing or prop would you like to keep from the movie?
Nene, there's very little. There's very little. We talked about this. The settings are very, very rough and very bare. There's little that we can keep. The attire of the main characters are also very reduced. I would love to keep the apron of Lib. She wears a white apron over her blue dress. With a huge pocket. She has a huge pocket where she keeps a wooden notebook where she keeps all her notes.
Oh.
And she always closes this wooden board with her notes, and she puts it in the apron. So I would love to keep the apron and the wooden board, because I make a lot of notes in my life. I love lists.
Oh my goodness. Wow. And I need that board.
And I need the apron to fit that board, because it was quite a big board.
Oh my God! See, that's amazing. Yeah, Well, the first time I watched this movie, it's like, my God, what am I keeping from this world? But I found it. Liv carries two leather bags. Oh my God! She carries one that is kind of closed, like a big, like a luggage. But she carries like across her body, like they have like this,
like a messenger bag.
Yeah, like a messenger bag. It's amazing. But she has another one, and I was doing research trying to find what type of bag this is, and I could not. And it's like a rolled leather bag. It's like a roll thing that it looks like something she will open. Maybe it's her medical.
Maybe it's her medical bag.
Maybe it's her medical bag, because it's like, you can see it's like a roll, like a leather roll bag. Maybe it's something that she can open and get her things. And I'm like, I want that. I want to keep that. I want it. I'm going to sing the Ariana Grande song. I like it. I got it. I want it. I got it. I'm messing up the lyrics. I got it.
Oh, that's a good one, isn't it? That's a really good one.
I want that bag. I really loved it. But the other one, if they give me the other one, I keep that one too. Because the other one is for her clothes and stuff. And the beauty is like, she's not, because she's a woman of action, right? She's a nurse. She's walking around. She's not carrying anything in her hands. They are both like bags that she puts across her body. They have long straps. So she, these are across her body like this. They are wonderful.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
All right.
Very good.
Okay, last question in the Wicks and Candles quiz. If given the chance, would you time travel to the period? Yes, no, and why?
Nene, this is an easy one for me. Definitely not.
Okay. But Irish people, please do not get offended.
No.
When
we talk about this question, of course, we are focused on exactly this time, and of course, this entourage. There were certainly happy people somewhere else in the world around 1862.
Yeah, of course.
But in this entourage and in this time, Nene, certainly not. The grade of this risk of falling into false beliefs and suffering from people believing in wrong things, it feels so oppressing. I don't know. It was a tough time. It was kind of on the verge of modernity, but still they were still so haunted with superstition. It felt kind of dangerous, kind of to live, as I said, in that surrounding, in that deeply conservative religious era, and knowing that there's actually the science was moving forward rather fast in those times, and and still having that people with such retrograde thoughts and like kind of. And this is where I'm going to throw the other candle that I wanted to throw before the quiz. what I found interesting in this film, even though the main character, Anna, or one of the main characters, Anna, is fasting, she's not eating, Lip eats a lot in that film.
Yes.
They show her a lot of times, several times, having breakfast, having dinner, eating stew, eating soups and porridge, uh-huh, and so on. Yeah. And she eats a lot, funnily enough.
She eats a lot in this movie.
She eats a lot.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really look delicious.
No.
And I love food. And I really love food. But this, also the surrounding of how she eats, you feel like the heart or the inn where she's eating is damp and cold. And sometimes she eats with a wooden spoon. It takes away your appetite.
Hmm. Wow.
Those are the reasons why I wouldn't like to travel to that time and spot of Earth. How about you? Would you time travel?
Oh my God. I want to, yes. I want to respond to the food part, okay, first. I don't know what to make of it, but it has some meaning. It has to mean something. It, true, the food does not look delicious, but she does. There's a lot of scenes of her eating and thinking.
Mm-hmm.
When she's eating, she's thinking. When mm-hmm. We haven't talked specifically about Florence Pugh's performance. Yeah, she has that one scene when she's a bit too modern. And I think that's a directing mistake. I think that's something I was like, oh my God, they could have done a couple more takes of this. Mm. That's what I thought. Mm. It's like, but they didn't. Or if they did, they chose the wrong one. Or the director said it's fine when it wasn't. Because I noticed that scene as well. And I was like, oh, that's a little bit odd. But man, the rest, Florence Pugh's face. Before I say if I will go to this play, I just want to talk about Florence Pugh for a little bit. I first saw Florence Pugh in Midsommar. This is a true horror film, one of the most horrifying films I've ever seen. It traumatized me, but I highly, highly recommend it. It's a masterful film. Prepare yourself. If you watch it, if you have seen it, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, a warning, it is not an easy film. But there's a scene in that movie with Florence Pugh, change of expression from just normal. There's a scene in that movie where her change of expression is so extraordinary in a second that it haunts me. It's like that one scene where she's just going about her day and somebody mentions something that causes deep distress, and the change in her face is one of the most masterful things I've seen in a long time in any actress. And it still haunts me to this day. She is amazing. And this movie is all about her face, and she's thinking a lot. And I don't know how actors do this, but you can see her thinking all the time, especially when she's eating. What are they doing? She's doing this. She's showing me how she's processing things with her acting. It's amazing. I love her.
She could be your shining candle.
She could be my shining candle as well. I truly love this actress, and I love how she infused this character with such intelligence and compassion. And I think she kept her to the time. Anyway, if given the chance, will I time travel to the period? And I was thinking really hard about this, and I said, yes, I will go to 1862 Ireland. Even, I know, even to the rural place, even just to experience that nature, that space. But I have to admit, it's a very scary time, especially in that small town. But, oh man, I will travel to that time just to meet Lib, just to meet her, because she's such a formidable character. And you know what? This character And the parallels between her, between Lib, the journalist, and the family and the community made me really think about the past and our notions of the past, our, you know, our 2023 notions of 1862 Ireland. Modernity existed, civilization existed. Mm-hmm. People like Lib and the journalists mm-hmm. existed. They were no mm-hmm. rarities. They were, you know, how things were moving forward. So all their actions, I think, are very period appropriate. This is not 1500. This is mm-hmm. 1862. So this story, like you said, could happen. Sadly, mm-hmm. why would I say I'm not going to 1862 Ireland if today this could easily happen as well? So I'm being very smug and snob by saying, oh my God, I wouldn't go to that primitive time. Because today we have people with fanatical beliefs, just as fanatical as those based on religion. And we see it in so-called, you know, modern countries. I mean, we are in 2023 and you have countries that have such, like even the United States, changing laws to erase trans people from existence. You know what I mean?
Yes, totally. Yeah, so the dangers, and this is maybe why the story and the entire film is so
timeless.
It gives so much time. Timeless in a way. It gives so much.
Because this you can
could
use,
happen today.
Exactly, could happen today as well. You have people who are so religious and so, unfortunately, sadly, blinded by their beliefs, and instead of using it as a source of good, they use it as a source of repression in so many ways. So I will be saying, oh, I'm not going there because it's so dangerous and people are so backwards, when in reality, we haven't changed much.
True. Sad, but true. Yes.
Sad, but true. So I will go. I will meet.
You would go and you would meet Lib.
I will meet the journalist. This is an amazing character as well. Just writing the truth using, you know, his knowledge and experience. So I will go. Definitely a scary time, especially if you get caught in, you know, religious people with fanatical religious belief or the desire. You know, and as a woman
very,
at the
very
time.
Well.
But anyway, I will go and just, gosh, I will work with you. I will do whatever she wants me to do. I will be her. I will work with her. I will be her assistant. I will just help her. I will just help her out. If she opens a clinic, I will clean for her. I will be her receptionist.
Truly. Very well, Nene.
I am in love with
very
that
well.
Woman. She's so amazing.
Yes, very good. One thing that we disagree on, this is very unusual for the Wicks and Candles
team.
Well,
there you go. Maybe we're not soulmates after all.
We are.
All
very
right.
Well, Nene. Okay, Nene, to wrap up our discussion, we have to ask one final question. How many Wicks and Candles would you give the wonder where one is a very sweaty wick and 10 is all the wicks and candles available? What is your rating for the wonder?
Yeah, let's do this quick. I'm gonna give it an 8.
Okay.
What about you?
Very good. Thank you. I'm also gonna go, I was between 7 and 8. I'm also gonna go for an 8 because, as I said, the things that disturb me, they wait on quite a lot. The mistakes and the pace of the story and this exceptional girl territory that I observed on the character of Lib. And this, that it took me out with this modern scenes, that it took me out of the time. Don't make it a 10, they make it an 8, a solid 8.
All right. Okay. Well, 16... Wicks and Candles out of a potential 20 for The Wonder. So it's a totally worthy movie, and it's easy to find because it's available on Netflix. It's a Netflix film, so it should be available on all Netflix around the world. Okay, so I guess we can wrap it up with that, Gabby. Thank you again for the insight, your research, working on the script, this conversation has been amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nene. Thank you as well for your points of view. And yes.
And thank you, everybody.
The discussion.
Yeah, and thank you, everybody, for listening. We hope to see you next time. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Wicks and Candles is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher.
So go ahead and subscribe and follow us on Instagram at Wicks and Candles. Thanks for listening and see you next time.
Wicks and Candles is written, hosted, and produced by Andreina Romero and Gabriela Morgan Romero. The image design is by Pamela Rollin. The podcast theme music is the Concerto for Two Violins in D minor by Johann Sebastian Bach.